Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Joe Antos, the Wilson H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute. We will be talking to Joe about the nation's healthcare system and his thoughts on needed reforms. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. And it's a relatively slow week for fiscal news, as Congress is on recess. But there are still a few recent developments that are worth an update. Even aid to disaster victims is embroiled in partisan bickering. Congress left Washington for a two-week recess without passing a recovery aid package, and there's no hint of any compromise at the moment. Puerto Rico is apparently the cause of the impasse. And while that impasse continues, victims of hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, and wildfires await federal recovery aid. The long-delayed aid package first passed the House in January, only to stall for months. And the longer the wait, the more the price tag mounts to keep up with additional disasters. For instance, the House introduced a $17.2 billion package before the recess, which was up $3 billion from its previous package to help additional victims of Midwest floods and Southeast tornadoes. And if politics doesn't get in the way, sometimes oddities in disaster relief delivery can slow down the process. Apparently, some ruined crops already harvested and stored are actually not covered by crop insurance. The IRS is promising an overhaul to make filing taxes easier, but it could take up to 6 years and cost over $2 billion. Often a target of criticism, the IRS operates on a decades-old computer system and takes on over 1 billion cyber attacks each year. After years of funding slashes on the heels of several scandals, the IRS is seeing a rise in funding. In fact, if the agency's fiscal year 2020 budget request is honored, funding would surpass 2013 levels for the first time since then. The goal through modernization is to make dealing with the IRS like online banking, where taxpayers have online accounts. Politico put together an essay based on the book titled Firefighting by Ben Bernanke, Timothy Geithner, and Henry Paulson Jr. that was published in April. It reflects back on the 2008 financial crisis and whether the U.S. would be able to weather another similar crisis. Here are some of the segments from Politico's essay, which are effectively clips from the book Firefighting. As we pass the 10-year anniversaries of the defining events of the 2008 global financial crisis, it's a good opportunity to reflect on what happened, what we learned, and whether it could happen again. Certainly, none of the three of us, or our colleagues, had ever lived through a crisis like that one, a crisis that was in some ways worse even than the early stages of the Great Depression. The good news is that this time, concerted government action managed to stop the panic, stabilize the financial system, revive the credit markets, and help start a recovery that continues to this day. Indeed, on key dimensions, the U.S. recovery from the Great Recession compares favorably to recoveries from previous severe financial crises, both in the United States and abroad, and the recoveries of other advanced economies from this crisis. Yet even so, the crisis was extraordinarily damaging for both the United States and the world. Millions of Americans lost their jobs, their businesses, their savings, and their homes. The popular anger generated by the crisis and by longer-term trends of increasing inequality, insecurity, and social immobility has roiled our politics and our society. The authors go on to say that the U.S. government was not well prepared for the financial conflagration of 2008, which helps explain why this fire burned so hot, why the efforts to contain it often seem so messy, and even why that response became so wildly unpopular. Better preparation could have created better outcomes. A decade later, the vital question asked by the authors is whether the United States is better prepared today. They believe the answer is yes and no. There are better safeguards in place to avoid a panic in the first place. The financial equivalent of more aggressive fire prevention measures and stronger fire-resistant building codes. But the emergency authorities for government officials to respond when an intense crisis does happen are in many ways even weaker than they were in 2007. The book says the Dodd-Frank regulatory reforms and the U.S.-led global effort to increase bank capital have produced more robust defenses against potential crises. Together, these and other reforms should reduce the frequency and severity of financial crises, as long as they are preserved and not weakened over time. But stronger rules and stricter oversight will never prevent all crises. Bernanke, Geithner, and Paulson went on to say that despite the many positive elements of the Dodd-Frank reforms that Congress enacted in 2010, the final law curtailed rather than expanded the most effective firefighting tools, and they went on into detail on some of those tools that were limited by Congress. According to the authors, when another serious crisis does arrive, Congress may have the power to undo these limitations, but that's easier said than done. At a minimum, financial firefighters would have to spend time, energy, and political capital to get the trucks and hoses they need while the fire's already burning, which can intensify crises and increase their ultimate cost to taxpayers and the economy. And it's hard to look at the bitterly polarized politics of modern America and feel confident that unpopular but necessary actions would emerge when it mattered most. The financial system and the economy seem stronger today, but the world is full of risks. Although the extreme crisis is rare, someday it will come. And even though Washington is mired in a noisy state of gridlock, now is as good a time as any to fill in the gaps in the 2010 reforms and prepare for the worst. As a great philosopher warned, if you want peace, prepare for war. It's certainly an interesting perspective and read from three prominent figures that helped navigate the fallout of the Great Recession. Up next, Joe Antos will join me and Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby for an in-depth conversation on the nation's healthcare system. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Joe Antos, who is the William H. Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at American Enterprise Institute, also known as AEI. Welcome, Bob and Joe.
Thank you.
Good to be back, Chase.
We are going to talk about healthcare today, Joe, especially since you're a healthcare expert. But before we go down that road, I want to ask you a little bit about your role with AEI. So can you give our listeners a quick backdrop of what you do, why you do it, and what AEI is meant to accomplish?
Okay, great. Yeah, so the American Enterprise Institute is a think tank in Washington. It's considered market-oriented, you know, that word enterprise probably means something. But I would argue that politically, certainly in healthcare, we're not at any extreme. I personally work on policies that would promote market-based reforms, but I'm realistic about the limitations there. I recognize the need for appropriate government regulation. And of course, one would be a fool not to recognize the vast amount of taxpayer dollars going through very important healthcare programs, which we really ought to take another look at. So I write papers. I give interviews, fortunately.
Thank you for that.
And I'm always happy to talk with people about
this. Great. Well, we're happy to have you on. And Bob's a familiar voice, so I'm actually going to jump right into a question. We'll start with Bob, and then we'll roll to you, Joe. So, Bob, healthcare is incredibly important when it comes to the federal budget. So can you give us a quick backdrop of how maybe expensive healthcare is in the budget and maybe some of the challenges around cost growth?
Well, the federal government spends about $1 trillion a year on healthcare, actually a little bit more than that. And within 10 years, it's going to more than double under current projections. So it's an incredibly big part of the federal budget. And And it's the one that's growing faster than the economy. We've got an aging population, but it's also because healthcare costs grow faster than general inflation. And so you put that together, you make that a mandatory spending program, as most healthcare programs are, which means that they run on autopilot, and it becomes a driving force of federal spending. So it's getting control of healthcare costs is obviously, it's an important issue just because healthcare costs are important. It's a family issue. It's a business issue. It's a state issue. But it's certainly a very big issue for the federal budget.
Joe, follow up to that. What do you see as some of these specific challenges within the healthcare system for our nation, whether it's budget related or otherwise?
Right. So among the many problems that we have is, I think, people's expectations about what they should expect from healthcare and from their health insurance. I think people have a unrealistic view that healthcare should be free, and of course, nothing is free in the real world. Somebody has to pay for it, so free is really out of the question. But because there is this view that healthcare should be free, often and because we have a system that is very heavily subsidized, either through the government or through third-party payment, through insurance payments, people are insulated from knowing what the cost is, even though they're paying the full cost. They just don't know it. I regularly talk to people about insurance. Hardly anybody I run into knows what they pay in premiums. And the reason is they have employer-sponsored coverage. The premium's coming out of their check. They don't look at the pay stub. We don't get pay stubs anymore. But people don't look at that.
It's mostly
just
digital.
It's automatic. And when you pay your $20 copay at the doctor's office, you really don't know what's being paid. And of course, the answer is it's five, six times that. That's actually being paid that you're ultimately paying through the premiums or through your taxes, helping to support tax breaks for your health insurance or helping to support Medicare or Medicaid. So it's a big, complicated situation, and nobody really understands at that gut level where they could take personal action. What is it costing me? And then what are my alternatives?
So I guess, Joe, a question I have is, there are certain cost drivers within the healthcare system, and I'd love to hear what both of you have to say about what you think those cost drivers are. But it sounds like, from what you're saying, that perhaps one of the cost drivers is also the fact that we don't know how much it costs on an individual basis. We're sort of shielded from that reality, and thus we don't challenge the system in that regard to reduce that cost.
Yeah, that's right. But let's widen the we, because it isn't the average patient that is the only person we should be concerned about. It's his doctor, frankly, or her doctor that really matters. After all, why do we go to the doctor? Well, ideally, to get something fixed, but most of the time, it's to get advice.
I just enjoy the free reading.
And you have plenty of time out there in the waiting room those women's magazines from 1985 are really pretty fascinating.
I trend toward the golf magazines.
But, well, they're a little newer, 1990. Anyway, the quarterback, I think, for most people's healthcare is their personal physician. And that person wants to do the right thing. Why else would you become a physician? That person wants to do the right thing, trying to make the best medical judgment, that he or she can. But he knows nothing about what the costs are, and he can't tell you. And you can't find out from your insurance company either, because the insurance companies are really terrible. For example, if you need an elective surgery and you want to know, because you're going to pay a big deductible maybe and a lot of cost sharing, you want to know how much is going to be paid out of your pocket. And you're going to want to know if you go to Dr. X or Dr. Y, if they're equally good, which is the one that I pay less for? That's what you want to know. If you call your insurance company will not be able to answer that question. Now, there are technical reasons for that. I foresee a time, I hope it's soon, I fear it won't be, when we're really going to be interconnected enough so that when you're talking to your doctor about what to do, your doctor has on his screen something useful for him and for you, which is he knows which other physicians or treatment facilities are in your network, and he can pull up an accurate estimate of what you will actually pay out of pocket. And that depends on the insurance company sending that information. And we don't have that now. And that's why the whole business about consumerism is grossly overblown. If it operated more like a supermarket where you could see the actual prices that you pay, then you could have consumerism, especially if you could read the ingredients on the box. We can't read the ingredients, meaning we don't know what the quality of the product is going to be, and we can't find out the price. It's perfect.
And I want to get Bob in the conversation, but I have one question on follow-up on what you just said. When it comes to consumerism and having that menu or itemized list of what the costs are there any studies on sort of the psychology of how realistic it is that someone might actually shop around and what cost savings that could actually produce? Or is it more just about the accountability and transparency of the pricing?
Well, I think it's both. You're raising a really important point. All of the studies, which are, of course, are based on a system that we have, which provides almost no useful information to anybody, say that people don't shop. Well, that makes sense to me. I mean, if you can't get the information, you have no basis for looking around. We have a situation where the typical physician is more oriented to either sending you to a facility or a treatment within the network that he is in, the business network that he is in, which may not be the insurance network that you are in. So we have all kinds of mixed incentives that don't mesh. And so what we really need is to align these things so that, I mean, I'm speaking personally now. I want my doctor to be on my side. And I want my doctor for the next patient to be on that patient's side. And our financial circumstances, our insurance circumstances, our health circumstances are going to be different. So we want truly personalized medicine of the sort that will be facilitated by better information and better communication potentially 20 years from now.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I've been talking to Joe Antost and not so much Bob Bixby, and I want to get Bob back into the show here. So, Bob, I'm going to kick it over to you. I know you've got some burning questions for Joe. I have some more in mind as well, but let's hear what you've got for us.
Well, I'd just pick up a little bit on what you were talking about because I think it's really key. We always talk about what can we do to control healthcare prices, and you can always put a lid on things or just put a cap on things, but quality may suffer if you do that, or access to care may suffer. So the points that Joe is getting at, I mean, I think that injecting more competition into the system among providers and healthcare plans, I think consumer choice is really an important. But as Joe said, some of these, they're all success is dependent upon transparency, which we don't have right now. So that seems to be something to work on. And there are limits to what you could get because of certain healthcare services are not shoppable. Some are. And I think as we progress with things like, I don't know, MRIs are often invoked, or hip replacements or joint yeah. replacements, things that are done, colonoscopies, or you know, sort of routine right. Procedures. There
not,
might be
not a, for me yet.
well.
Given time,
your time. You have a lot to look forward to, Chase. Let me tell
so
you
so much.
You know, there's no limits. You can, but anyway, but let's just say that there are, we shouldn't, I don't think we should give up on consumerism or competition as the healthcare field develops and some procedures become more routine. Maybe there will be more effective markets provided that we can do transparency. So I think that that's one of the tough issues right now facing healthcare reformers is, can you make the competition, bring the consumer choice into it? Can we make that more effective than it is right now? But one of the interesting, just sort of moving away from the weeds right now and the healthcare reformers, is that we're here in New Hampshire. We have lots of presidential candidates coming through. And healthcare is an issue. And recently, the president surprised a lot of people, perhaps his own staff and cabinet, by saying that he wanted to get back into the healthcare reform debate and that the Republican Party should be the party of healthcare. Joe, you wrote a column in the New York Times with one of your colleagues at AEI, Jim Capretta, and put a little bit of a different spin on that. And I was just going to see if you could kind of explain your take on that.
So, our bottom line is that the Republicans should become the party of responsible healthcare. Yes, you're absolutely right. President Trump surprised everyone in his party. Mitch McConnell's response was way too honest for a typical politician. He said, "We'll look at your plan, Mr. President, when you send it to us." I think that's the right response.
He said, "I look forward to seeing what you can work out with Speaker Pelosi."
Yeah,
call me.
Yeah, exactly. We're concerned about the extremes that we see in Washington. You have people on this on the extreme left side of the agenda saying Medicare for all, whatever that actually means, but they're talking about a single-payer system, everybody's in the same thing. Well, we're going to make everything uniform, which might sound attractive to some people, but if you want to go there, nobody's exactly figured out how you would get there from where we are now. And it's not the solution. I don't believe it's really the solution for the United States. On the right, we've had this debacle among Republicans on the Hill. All of 2017 was wasted with first the House and then the Senate struggling, Republicans struggling with themselves over what they thought the Affordable Care Act should be replaced with. And the answer was that they never came to agreement, which is perfectly appropriate, in my opinion, because certainly by now, but even in 2017, the Affordable Care Act, the key rules that have changed the insurance market had been in place for 3 years and now in place for 5 years. And some of those rules are very important, and they're going to be retained. They're not going to be changed. In particular, the protection for people with pre-existing conditions. Every politician has said, every Republican, every Democrat has said, we need to protect people who have pre-existing conditions, which in general terms means that they should be able to buy health insurance. They should not be excluded. And if someone has a heart condition, necessary treatments for heart conditions should not be excluded from their benefit package. That's perfectly reasonable. Republicans say this, and in the context of replacing the ACA, they don't really have a specific plan. But the fact is that they've all assimilated it, and it's right, and it's not going to leave. It's not going to leave us. That's one of the founding principles of the ACA, and we're going to hold on to that. It's not going anywhere. But a lot of other things about the ACA simply didn't pan out, or were very poorly designed. And were bad ideas, and we need to work on those.
And all right, so I want to piggyback off of this conversation sort of in the political side of things and how changes in the system would actually work. We're in the New Hampshire primary. We're quickly approaching 2020. A lot of candidates coming through this studio and down Main Street and in living rooms all over the state. You mentioned what you didn't think was great for the United States in terms of a healthcare system, and you mentioned some of the things that are probably going to stick around no matter what, whether it's Republican or Democrats in the majority. How would you reframe the healthcare conversation right now for presidential candidates. What would you like to see them discussing? And we can get as weedy as you want. That's what we do here. It may not be a realistic thing for the candidates, but what would you hope to hear from them on this topic?
Well, let me, you know, I think I want to divorce myself from political candidates on both sides. But let's say a responsible discussion might start with how we subsidize health care for people. We do a lousy job of it. The ACA did a very good thing by recognizing that people who buy health insurance on their own, they tend to be lower income people. They don't have jobs with big companies. They tend to have lower wages. These are precisely the people who have a tough time affording a lot of things, including health insurance. And so and they're also the only people in this country who don't get a federal subsidy for some kind of health insurance. Just to remind people, if you have coverage through your employer, you're getting a big tax break. It may not be obvious to you, but it's true. If you're on Medicare, obviously, you're getting a huge subsidy from the taxpayer. If you're on Medicaid, that's heavily subsidized, and there are a few other programs. But there, you know, something like 25 million people or maybe 30 million people who either were buying insurance on their own or were uninsured altogether. And they were not eligible for subsidies under the old way. They couldn't buy, many of them couldn't buy insurance, but they weren't being subsidized. And if they bought it on their own, if it cost $100, it was $100 of theirs. Nobody was paying them to help them buy this coverage. So we need to fix that. But we also need to fix the way we subsidize Medicaid. One of the things that the ACA did was it said, okay, if states expand Medicaid eligibility, fine with me. We will pay more. We will pay initially 100% of the cost that the states bear, and then ultimately by 2020, I believe, it drops down to 90%. But 90% of the cost is higher than what states now get for their regular Medicaid beneficiaries. And I'm talking about poor children. I'm talking about poor mothers. States get somewhere between 50% of their costs from the federal government and something like 70% of the cost. It kind of varies around. Nothing like 90%. It doesn't make sense to me as a national policy that we're going to subsidize people who are above the poverty line more than people who are below the poverty line. And there's a lot of money there. So I would look to readjust that. Now, this is not going to be popular with a lot of people, but we should help the people who need the help most first. And then when there's money left over, because we're a rich country, there will be money left over, then let's figure out about how we can help those a little bit higher up on the scale. Similarly, on the people who are buying on the exchanges, you know, we had a few years of very, very high premium increases. It's just settled down now. But who are the people who left the exchange coverage? It's by and large the people who weren't eligible for premium subsidies. And again, we're not talking about wealthy people. At 400% of poverty, you know, that's probably something like $90,000 for a family of four. And in a lot of parts of this country, that's not a lot of money. And it's a family of four. So we need to do more. And actually something that Nancy Pelosi mentioned, I thought was a good idea. She said, why don't we find some money to ease the subsidies up a little bit higher so that the people who've basically been squeezed out, the lower middle class people who've been squeezed out, they need some help. We ought to do that. I agree with that. But the way we do that is, well, let's take some money out of where we're really spending it foolishly, and let's try to improve efficiency in the system.
One of the questions that comes up, I mean, the design of the Obamacare subsidies was supposed to be that there had to be a mandate. In order to get people to buy, there had to be a mandate with a penalty, because that's the way and the only way you would make coverage for pre-existing conditions work. The deal with the insurance companies was, well, if we're going to have to cover everybody, then we have to make sure that we have a broad enough market. And the way you do that is to have a mandate and a penalty enforce it. I think you were somewhat skeptical or critical of the way that was structured. So the penalty has been reduced to zero. People are still signing up for the subsidies. And do you feel that the absence of a mandate is going to ultimately harm the program, or do you think that that was a good fix?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting about the mandate. I think the mandate did have an important purpose for the first year or so, because it did two things. One was it got every news outlet, every Twitter feed, you know, people were talking about this. They would talk about there's this new plan for health insurance, which is good because otherwise, how else would anybody know? So it got a lot of publicity for that first year. 2013 was the first year you signed up. 2014 was the first coverage year. And so it attracted people's attention. And there was always a tagline about that there was a penalty if you didn't buy coverage. Now, it got people's attention. But how do people really understand it? Well, they hear it on TV, but they don't quite get it. They don't read to the page 15 of the article in the newspaper. They don't read the newspaper. What do? They go to their neighbor and they say, have you heard about this? Do you know anything about it? Is there supposed to be some kind of a penalty? And that first year, every neighbor in this country said, penalty? Well, I don't know anything about it. And that's because no penalty, of course, was being levied on anybody until actually 2015 at the earliest, and in many cases, not even then. But it got people's attention. What really sold the policies, however, were the policies. So good thing that there was the big subsidies for people for the premiums, because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to afford it. But, you know, who signed up? It was largely people who were eligible for substantial subsidies for premiums and also some help paying for what's called cost sharing, which you can think of as that $20 you pay for your doctor when the doctor's visit. Well, in the case of actually very good plans on the exchanges, oftentimes there was a $5,000 annual deductible. And for low-income people, that's the same thing as not getting covered at all. So people who got those subsidies signed up. People who didn't get those subsidies, some of them did sign up and then realized, I can't afford this. And they've been slowly moving off the program, which is why I think Nancy Pelosi said we ought to do something about this. So the mandate had a purpose then, but it doesn't have a purpose anymore. And what Bob was saying was very important. If you're an insurance company, you're going to have no trouble recruiting sick people who need services right now and who are being subsidized. The problem you have is recruiting young, healthy people who, especially guys, who can't imagine ever going to the doctor and somehow imagine that it'll be taken care of because that's the way guys are. Believe me, I was one once too.
formerly the man known as Joe Antos.
Yes, indeed, indeed. So that's really an important point. However, here we get to something that is a little nerdy, but it shows that even when the legislation isn't easy to understand, sometimes it works. So what happened? I won't explain the policy, but essentially insurers realized that some money that they were supposed to get from the federal government wasn't going to be coming, and some money was $7 billion. Over 10 years. That's a lot of money, even for insurance companies. And so they said, well, okay, we've got to restructure our premiums. And how do we do this? We need more money to keep these plans alive and to keep the sick people getting the services that they need, right? And so what they did was that they jacked up a certain set of premiums because the subsidies were tied to the level of those premiums. And so, in fact, making that mandate go away didn't have much effect in the first place. But now we really don't need it because the insurance industry outfoxed the bureaucrats and realized, hey, we could still get our money just through this other route. The net result will be more taxpayer dollars, but people getting the subsidies, as long as they choose the right plan, don't pay one penny more for their insurance. And oftentimes, with the higher subsidies, they could actually get a better plan with a lower deductible, better coverage all the way around financially, and have it actually be affordable. So this has oddly been a win-win, and some folks on the left claim that that was sabotaged by the Trump administration. Went the other way, folks. Sorry.
I have follow-up question that is, as you're describing that, it seems to me that the reform of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, as people call it, I know that you and you meaning AEI and similar scholars at Brookings, which is usually associated being, you know, center left, and AEI maybe being center right, did collaborate recently on a set of principles or proposals that the Senate Help Committee, so-called Help Committee, chaired by Senator Alexander from Tennessee, and of course Senator Hassan is on that committee from New Hampshire. Anyway, you collaborated on a set of things, and it seems to me that those are good, reasonable, and boring policies that can solve the problem. And the political debate that we hear is either that seems satisfying to the political base of either party is repeal Obamacare. It's a terrible thing. It's horrible, horrible, horrible. Or Medicare for all. We have to have universal coverage, Medicare for all, whatever that means. And neither one, it seems to me, this is a political judgment on my part, I suppose, seems likely to happen politically. And there are things that, ironically, that we could do that could have some bipartisan support, but they're not as exciting.
And precisely right. None of the things we proposed would make probably even page 50 of the average large newspaper. I'm grateful. I think we were all grateful, involved in this project, grateful that the Help Committee asked this question, because I think my colleagues at AEI and my colleagues at Brookings, we all felt that there's time for reasonable proposals that could actually do something rather than a lot of random talk that will not lead to useful legislation on either side. So yeah, these are boring policies.
It's not without hope. I mean, there are solutions.
Right, there are solutions. You have to chip away at it a bit at a time. There is no magic bullet here. That's part of the problem. Politicians need the magic bullet, but reality says you have to work on specific problems with specific solutions.
And you have to have a from here to there. You're not going to just repeal Obamacare. It's not going to happen. You're not going to get Medicare for all, not so long as we have a divided House and Senate.
Right, exactly. And so my colleague Jim Capretta and I, one of our themes, not just for this recent article, but for most of what we've written in the last few years, is you have to take a reasonable view. You have to start from where you are rather than where you'll never be in order to get to someplace that is actually reasonable in terms of cost, in terms of access, in terms of quality, in terms of innovation in healthcare. All those things really matter, but there are trade-offs. You can't have it all, and you've got to have a policy or a set of policies that allow reasonable people to make their own decisions about how they want to deal with their personal healthcare and their personal expenditures. And we also want to have national and state policies that do the same thing.
Well, I think that's as good a place as any to leave it. I had some more questions, but we're running low on time. And as they say, timing is everything. Thank you so much, Joe Antos from AEI, and of course, Bob Bixby, our executive director. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Chase.
This is Facing the Future. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. The nation's debt buildup is unsustainable. The longer policymakers wait to engage in reform, the more drastic change will have to be. And this time, it's not us saying it. It's a message delivered by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, or GAO. There's a familiar ring to the latest report by the GAO on the nation's fiscal health, and that is not a good sign. The new report reiterates GAO's past warnings about the federal government's budget problems and the lack of responsible action, and then discusses how things have gotten worse since the last such report was issued only 10 months ago. GAO says Congress and the administration face serious economic, security, and social challenges that require difficult policy choices in the near term in setting national priorities and charting a path forward on economic growth. It also reminds elected officials that the federal government is already highly leveraged in debt by historical norms. The new report says that longer-term fiscal projections show the federal government is on an unsustainable fiscal path. The key drivers of growing federal spending are expected to be healthcare programs due in part to an aging population and snowballing interest on the debt. GAO points out that it is not alone in its general assessment of unsustainability. Supporting evidence comes from the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, and the fiscal year 2018 financial report of the United States government. They all show, without policy changes, the federal government's debt-to-GDP ratio will surpass its historical high of 106% within 13 to 20 years, which GAO notes is sooner than projected last year. The GAO says the 2018 financial report and CBO also agree that the longer corrective action is delayed, the greater the changes will have to be. Many other analysts and organizations, including the Concord Coalition, have also warned that procrastination in Washington will make the needed reforms more difficult and require greater public sacrifices. The GAO report includes a troubling timeline of fiscal difficulties and milestones in the years ahead. This year, Social Security spending will surpass $1 trillion in annual spending. In 2025, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation's multi-employer trust fund will be depleted. In 2026, Medicare's hospital insurance trust fund will be depleted. That same year, Medicare and Medicaid spending will each surpass $1 trillion annually, and so on. In discussing the past year, GAO notes that the federal deficit in fiscal year 2018 increased to $779 billion, which was up from $666 billion the previous year. In fact, in a separate report last week, the Treasury Department said that the deficit just for the first half of fiscal year 2019 was already slightly over $691 billion. The GAO says federal receipts increased by only $14 billion in the last fiscal year when new tax cut legislation took effect. Spending, meanwhile, increased by $127 billion. Politicians, of course, often blame increased federal spending on the other party. But the spending increases last year, GAO says, were driven by, among other things, increases in defense, interest on debt held by the public, Social Security, Medicaid, and disaster relief and flood insurance. Aside from interest costs, each of these other items enjoys strong support from Republicans, Democrats, or both. That support seldom comes with credible financing plans. This new GAO report also raises another warning flag about fiscal risks, which is the potential for programs, activities, and responsibilities that could, based on current policy or past practices, put additional pressure on the federal budget. You may recall last week's Facing the Facts segment, during which I discussed GAO's separate report on fiscal exposures that create such risks. The agency's broader report on the nation's fiscal health also includes a welcome reminder of the need for congressional action on the federal debt limit. While waiting for such action, the Treasury Department is currently falling back on what is called extraordinary measures to avoid the government defaulting on some of its debts. The GAO calls for preserving the full faith and credit of the United States and points out that the debt limit is not a control on debt, but rather an after-the-fact measure that restricts the Treasury's authority to borrow to finance the decisions already enacted by Congress and the President. Many organizations have suggested alternative approaches to the current debt limit. Unfortunately, Congress has yet to take action. The GAO's fiscal health report provides a broad overview of what ails the federal budget, and it emphasizes the fundamental importance of sweeping reforms. And the report deserves careful review by lawmakers, administration officials, candidates for any federal office in 2020, and voters who want to know more about what fiscal concerns they should expect those candidates to address. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.